Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Why Would You Tell Me That, which is a podcast hosted by me, Dave Moore, and him, Neil Delamere, in which we bring you tales of things you don't know, but you probably should. And we're absolutely loving it. We're in season 5. It's kind of amazing that we're this far into it, Neil, considering we absolutely despise each other.
Exactly, yeah, and Vivaldi, I mean, that's one more than Vivaldi. What a waster. He just quit at 4, and we've already gone on to 5. And who knows, with global warming, there'll either be 1 or 75 seasons. Like, in fairness, even Crowded House manages to do 4 seasons in one solid 24-hour period. So we've them to aim for, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, look, here's the thing. This week, it is your turn to wow us. So we'll let Neil do that in a few minutes' time. A couple of bits of housekeeping we always need to get to at the start. One is to tell you that you should get in touch with us. You should follow us. You should friend us. You should be involved in the podcasting community of Why Would You Tell Me That? So you can do that by, first of all, leaving us a gorgeous 5-star review. Spotify, Apple, wherever it is you're listening to this, just give it a little clickety-click there and go, I love the lads. They're so class. Or just 5 stars, whatever you want. But yeah, do that for us. Then also follow us at Why Would You Tell Me That on Instagram. He's at the Neil Delamere Comedy and I'm at Dave Today FM. And yeah, other than that, we should say we're proudly part of the Acast Creator Network, and we're here to do some podcasting.
I'll tell you what we're going to talk about. Then we'll take a slight detour.
Oh, okay? I love it. I love detours.
So we started off talking about what season we're on. So let's talk time. Today, we're going to talk about the time that France banned Sundays. No more Sundays. Pas de dimanche, whatever it is.
Pas de dimanche.
No more Sundays. Yeah. They just went, no more Sundays. So in part two, we're going to talk to Dr. Matthew Shaw, the librarian at Queen's College, Oxford.
Ooh.
And he literally has a PhD in the subject.
A PhD on the anti-Sunday French movement.
Yes, that's essentially what he has, yeah. Now, before we get to that, I'm glad you mentioned leaving us a review, because we have been remiss in not thanking the people who have left us reviews. So some time ago, you and I said, leave 5-star reviews. And then it kind of migrated and changed and metamorphosized into, we don't care what you write. Then it said, you can review another podcast, but leave us a 5-star review.
Yeah.
And then we thought no more about it. Well, Dave, it seems people took that to heart. I have looked at some of the reviews.
Brilliant.
Here's one for you. 5 stars, which is what we want. A pair of intellectual and thought-provoking podcasters. Do you always enjoy listening to Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell, right? So that's another podcast, but we have gotten their 5-star review.
Excellent.
That's The Rest Is Politics. 5 stars. I love listening to this. Emily Maitlis et al. Rock, which is the News Agents podcast.
Well, we did ask, because apparently the logic is, if you don't know, that apparently Apple's algorithm works in that it's just the 5-star rating that counts.
It doesn't matter what they're writing.
The text doesn't matter. Whereas, why do they leave the thing for the text? Nobody seems to know, but it's just the 5-star. So yeah, just keep going. Review it. Review movies. Review like chicken fillet rolls. Like review whatever you want. Like
review anything. Review car doors. Review anything at all. Nice guys. Good rapport. Very fun accents. Highly recommend you check out Cautionary Tales of Tim Harford.
That's definitely written by Tim Harford, which I actually love.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite guest hosts now. What do you think of this? Of the Bugle, Neil, is why would you tell me that? The Bugle and No Such Thing as a Fish. The smartest, funniest Brit podcast going. Oh, They give with one hand, they take away with the other.
Look, I'll be honest with you, Neil. I'll take it. If it's got a five-star review, I'm absolutely delighted with that. You know what I mean?
He'll take 30 pieces of silver as long as they are English sterling pounds, my friend. So keep leaving us five-star reviews. Thank you very much. And the weirder...
But do review your favourite carrot.
Yeah, your favourite. Yeah, the bizarrest review. I would love that.
Yes. Review like a swimming lesson you got in 1986. Like, I don't care what it is. Just review anything that isn't us. Give us five stars and review something else. That's what I'm waiting on.
Review stars. Just, yeah. Well, my favorite nebula is the nebula at five stars, and then it just come up on ours. Okay, we're talking about France today, right? So okay. Let's give you some French facts. Now, you've heard of Veuve Clicquot.
Veuve Clicquot, yeah. Veuve Very Clicquot. Expensive champagne.
Second biggest champagne in the world, biggest selling champagne in the world. 18 million bottles a year.
Jesus.
Which is a lot of ships launched and a lot of Formula One races celebrated, my friend. What, given that you are the French speaker here, although I was pretty good at school, what does Veuve Clicquot mean?
Well, I always assumed that Veuve Clicquot was the name of a stripper in Montmartre.
Veuve.
I have no idea what Veuve Clicquot means.
Okay, Clicquot is the Clicquot family. That's her surname. Okay. And Veuve is widow.
Ah. So you've got that insurance company in Scotland, the Scottish widow.
Yeah.
And now you've got champagne called the Clicquot widow. But I did not know that's what it meant.
Les Veuves d'Écosse. Scottish widows.
Yes.
Yes.
Look at you, Neil.
I'm telling you, I was pretty good.
You were.
So this is a real person, and this is the person who set up the famous champagne. So she was born Barb Nicole Ponsardin in Rennes, and her dad was a textile industrialist. So he was pretty well minted, right? Okay. She grew up in this large family estate called Hotel Ponsardin, and who lived next door? Only the Clicquot family, right? So Philippe is the dad there.
Yeah.
And he's also a textile industrialist. So he's a son called Francois. So what do the two dads do? They go, why don't we marry the offspring and consolidate the holdings? So young Francois and Barb get married, 1798. She's 21, right?
Yeah.
So Francois is interested in growing his family's wine business. Now, his dad isn't that massively interested in this. You know, this was kind of a minor portion of the family business.
Okay, so they're involved in something else, and the son is doing what the sons do, going, I don't want to do what my dad does and work, I want to do something different.
Yeah, that's exactly how he talked in the 18th century France. Yeah, I want to forge my own path in the world. Yeah, I want to do things. This Napoleon fella from Corsica looks like he's a bit of an upstart. I think I'll go and follow him. Yeah, that's pretty much. So they had a bit of a kind of an interest in the wine business. Philippe sold wine as the afterthought to the textile business. So he would add white wine to orders to round them out.
Right, not to textiles. He's like, you know, listen, I know you wanted the beautiful textile for to hang on your wall, but I spilled a lot of wine on it and I sell it to you now for more money.
What I have done is I have cleverly doubled my wine sales by spilling first red wine and then spreading the myth that if you also pour white wine on that, it will get the stain out. Oh God, it's like Peter Sellers is here. The accents are amazing. Right. So Philippe would buy wine from wine producers and just kind of throw it in with the shipment, you know?
Right.
No intention of expanding this. 1805, 6 years after their marriage, and they loved each other, by the way. They were really into each other. Francois.
Can I be honest? Because I was worried when you said that she was the widow Clicquot and that she wasn't in fact Clicquot. She married into Clicquot. And I had a fear this was a kind of a Poirot mystery where, you know, all of a sudden she married in and everyone died and only the widow was left.
No, there's no suggestion of that.
Okay,
I like
okay.
the way that's how you think. And I think that says a lot about you and indeed your family and your will. No, he dies of a fever, apparently.
Aww.
And so Barb Nicole goes to her father and says, listen, I'd like to risk my entire inheritance and I'd like you to give me an extra $1 million, the equivalent of
really
to run this wine business. And he goes, yeah, okay. To his daughter-in-law, who's now
his daughter-in-law.
Yeah, yeah. And then it doesn't work. And his previous investment didn't work. Then he decided to give her the £1 million the second time, right? But he insisted, her father-in-law, that she would go through an apprenticeship, after which she would be able to run the business herself.
Well, he's right. I mean, any good wine vineyard always has either a good sparks, you know, a good electrician, or a chippy. Like, solid apprenticeship is what you need.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Christ.
For a second there, Neil actually had a point. He really got to do something about vineyards.
Oh, my God, no, man, he's a well-traveled man. I know he doesn't like wine that much, but maybe this is a point that can layer, like a good textile tapestry. He could layer more texture to this. No, he was going for joke.
I burst the pipe in your jacks and I leaked all over your analogy.
Listen, the analogy I think is gone. Who put in your last analogy? That would be the last one. No, he's after putting a metaphor in where he should have put an analogy now. I've seen that before now. I've got a simile in the van. You'd like that.
It's great. It's a bit expensive now, but it's great.
But he insists that she becomes an apprentice. Okay. And so she spends 4 years in Derry closing the walls off to impending attack. You see, I can do what you did as well. With an equally nonsense fact.
Yes.
So she does. She spends 4 years with Alexandre Fourneau and she learns how to make wine, right?
Okay.
This is the first time she's gotten £1 million. So then she goes to him second time and says, can I do this? And he goes, okay, here's the other £1 million. The equivalent of. And this is around the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and she has in her cellars what will become the legendary vintage of 1811, right? But she's facing bankruptcy at this point. She takes a massive risk. She thinks that the Russian market, as soon as the Napoleonic War ends, they'll be mad into champagne, right?
Right.
So what she does is she smuggles the vast majority of her wine out of France as far as Amsterdam, because there's a naval blockade. And as soon as peace is declared, her shipment gets to Russia.
Wow.
Beating the competitors that she had by weeks. And soon after her champagne gets there, the Tsar goes, this is the only kind I will drink. And suddenly, Russian court preference, boom, she is sorted.
Okay. And is it only then in Russia, or does the Russian court preference kind of, you know, spread across the courts of the rest of Europe going, well, if it's good enough for the Russian Tsar?
Yeah, it is. It's the Tsar. Oh, brilliant. But now she has to figure out how does she keep up with demand? Right now, champagne is made by adding sugar and live yeast to bottles of white wine, and it creates what is known as secondary fermentation. Right, but when the yeasts digest the sugar, the byproducts created are alcohol and carbon dioxide, which give the wine bubbly, bubbly, bubbly. Right.
Okay.
However, when the yeast consumes all the sugar, it dies, and you get sediment and dead yeast at the bottom of it, and this is unappetizing. Right. So. Right. It makes it look cloudy. And what they used to do was the champagne makers would pour the finished product from one bottle into another bottle to get rid of the yeast.
Gotcha.
And it takes ages and it's time consuming. It's wasteful and right. It agitates the bubbles and it affects the quality of the wine. She invents something, a method that kept the wine in the same bottle, but consolidated the yeast by gently agitating the wine. She turned them upside down and turned them slowly. So the bottles were turned upside down and twisted, causing the yeast to gather in the neck of the bottle. And it's called riddling, and it's still used by modern champagne makers.
No.
If you look up champagne, and no one else figured out what she was doing for years, so it allowed her to make more and do it quicker.
Yeah.
And they still do it.
And just so I understand, and maybe you do or do not know the answer to this question, but when the bottle is turned upside down and the yeast goes into the neck, is it extracted from there or is it still there?
I knew you'd ask me that. So modern ways, they used to do it by hand.
Right.
Now they still do that. They still do riddling. And any sediment by the end of the riddling stage is in the neck, right? And it's ready for disgorgement. That's the next stage of this. So in the modern manufacturing process, the bottleneck is plunged into a solution that's about -27°C. So the frozen plug, the sediment forms this frozen plug. So they remove the sediment by opening the bottle, expels the plug due to the pressure, so all the yeast now is gone.
Right.
And then, very quickly, they fill it back up. I didn't know this. So a small amount of wine is forced out with the sediment plug, shall we say.
Yeah.
And during the next stage, dosage. The bottle is topped up with a mixture of cane sugar and wine. Very, very little now.
Yeah. But enough.
Approximately
to
1 cl for a 75 cl bottle of champagne.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. And then they pop the cork in, and it's ready to go.
Bob's your uncle.
Incroyable.
Yeah, and it is still the second biggest selling champagne in the world because one, of her getting there before everybody else, and two, her inventing this new technique of manufacture.
Unreal. I don't drink alcohol, and I got engaged in New York in 2003. And friends of mine who were in on the surprise engagement with my then girlfriend and fiance and then wife booked us a gorgeous meal in a restaurant that's on Central Park South. It's called 1CPS. His address is literally 1 Central Park South. It's part of the Plaza Hotel. So they booked us in there and we went in. It was the fanciest place I've ever been, Neil. And there was a maitre d', like he brought us over. He sat us in the seat at the window, got us the best seat in the house. And he brought over 2 flutes of not Veuve Clicquot,
yeah,
but Laurent Perrier.
Ooh.
And it was a Laurent Perrier Rosé Champagne. And he popped it down. Now, I don't drink. So standard situation is like that. I'll either go, listen, thanks a million. I don't drink. You can take it back. Or usually what I do is go, thanks a million. He walks away and I give it to my missus and she has 2 drinks. Everyone's happy.
Yeah.
But I just got engaged and I looked at her and I said, here, cheers. I'm going to drink this. So we clinked our little glasses. And we went to drink the champagne and Tracy did what people do and they sipped the champagne and the bubbles and the
dissolve on the tongue
and all the whiny things. And I just went, knocked back an entire glass of champagne.
Yeah.
It is easily the fizziest thing I've ever drank. And for the rest of our unbelievably romantic, incredible, literally life-altering moment of our meal.
Yeah.
The first thing we did as an engaged couple, I just said, was like, you know, like, I just can't believe that, like, you said you'd marry me.
And,
I'm just that you did. And I burped the entire way through it. And I could not stop burping to the point where she just eventually found it comical. Thank Jesus.
I mean, usually it goes to absolute shit after the marriage. After the wedding happens. For you to just demonstrate that low moral standing.
Straight away.
Immediately.
Look, you've got to set the bar as low as is going to be realistic in the marriage. And then you can only go up from there. So burping my way through a romantic meal was about as bad as it got.
No, it could definitely get worse than that. I thought you were going to froth at the mouth. You come to some sort of rabies, hydrophobia thing.
Oh, no.
Just it coming out your nose going, I think our kids will be mixed, half Catholic, half Soda Stream by the looks of things. Some big Niagara Fall head.
No, thankfully none of that happened. I just had a bad case of the burps.
Oh,
and that's the only time I've ever had a drink.
The only time you've ever had an alcoholic drink at all? No.
Yeah, ever.
So if you get engaged again... Is that the next time?
I'll go on the absolute lash because if I lose her, then I'm in serious trouble. She's the only thing keeping me afloat, in fairness.
Yeah, I've met a lady and you are frankly a mess without her. Let me move back to the same time in France. You might have figured out, by the way, that when the French calendar was changed to get rid of Sundays, we're talking about this time.
Like, we're in this era. Okay, I gotcha. Yeah.
So let's stick with the words La Veuve. What do you think was called La Veuve at the time of the French Revolution? The widow. It was a thing.
Yeah. Is it like something war related, like a cannon or a ship or something?
No, you're close though. A guillotine, the guillotine.
The guillotine was called the widow. Yes. Not really the widow maker, but go on, yeah.
Yeah, I know it has some great names. There's some brilliant names. We'll get to them in a second. France executed its last prisoner by guillotine in what year?
Oh, I think I've actually heard this. And I think it's terrifyingly recent.
It is terrifyingly recent.
Is it the 50s?
It is last week. It's not last week. It's the 19th of September, 1977.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I was in your 2.5.
Yes, and that is the only reason. You were tried as a minor, and that is why you got away with it. They merely cut off his guitar hand. That didn't happen, I think. If that happened, we'd all be secretly grateful.
77.
Elvis was number one way down in Ireland and the UK, yeah? I looked it
up. That is so crazy.
So, my question is, though, is why is the guillotine named the guillotine?
Oh, I'm kind of at the francophone questions. I should have done some more research. I'm letting myself down here. J'ai aucune idée. I have no idea why.
It's named after Mr. Guillotine.
Oh, bloke.
Yeah, yeah. Who was a member of the National Assembly. And guess how Mr. Guillotine died?
No. This is like your man who invented Pringles, who got his ashes shot into space in the Pringles can. Did he actually get his head cut off?
No, he died of carbuncle. Nothing to do with the guillotine. Nothing whatsoever. A complete setup. I can't believe you don't know me well enough by now.
Yeah, fair.
But what's really interesting about him, first of all, when he died in 1814 at the age of 75, which is a great age in those days, his family were so embarrassed by the guillotine connection that they asked the French government to change the machine's name, and the government refused, so they changed their family name instead.
Of course, I suppose, yeah, if you're going to be like, you know, associated with a machine of death is probably not what you want your kids growing up with.
Yeah, they all changed their name to Les Injections Lethales, which is a surprise.
La chaise électrique.
So there are some great names. Le Moulin à Silence, the Silence Mill. Les Bois de Justice, Timbers of Justice. Timbers of Justice. Justice Timberlake, it should have been. My favorite is La Monte à Regret, which is the regretful climb. Oh. That sounds like a one-night stand. That's what I like. Someone got lucky last night. Oh, that was a regretful climb, let me tell you.
The walk of shame or the regretful climb, whichever one you're having.
What's really interesting about him, though, is that he was against the death penalty. This is what I like.
Ah, stop. The fellow who invented the guillotine, gave his name to it, was against the death penalty.
So he didn't invent it. So it's named after him, but he didn't invent it.
What?
The machine at the start was called a Louisette or a Louison after its inventor, French surgeon and physiologist Antoine Louis.
Like, correct me if I'm wrong. Hang on. But surgeons and physiologists, you know, would take a well, I don't know what era they did, but would take a Hippocratic oath, you know, to like try and save people's lives. Even if there was no Hippocratic oath at that point, you know, you would still kind of go, look, you're a doctor of note, of merit. Your job is to save people. What do you want to do, sir?
I want to invent something that immediately slices the head off a prisoner, ending their life in an instant. But they will still flop around on the floor and their eyes will stare out at the crowd.
Hold on. Whoa, there's a lot to unpack there now. Now, it's not a chicken that you're thinking of. They're not flopping around in the floor.
No, they did.
No, they did not.
They did.
So I'll tell you why he it's named after him.
Right.
He was completely against the death penalty, but he passed a law, or was instrumental in passing a law, that required all sentences of death to be carried out by a means of machine. And the reason this was is because at this point, this is bizarre, the privilege of execution by decapitation. What a privilege that would be.
Oh, huge privilege.
Listen, sir, just take your seat there. Yeah, we're going to lop your head off, but in a privileged sort of way. That was confined to nobles, essentially. So it's going to be quick and painless, and they chop a noble's head off. But before that, you're the old peasant, you've robbed something, you've been sentenced to death, a hanging, burning,
any sort of hideous stuff.
So basically, he's kind of trying to make it as humane as possible. Okay. If they do have to go, they have to go. But one way or the other, the man who after whom the guillotine is named was anti-death penalty.
Right.
Let me throw one more nugget at you. We're talking about a state in turmoil in terms of the French Revolution, right?
Yeah.
So let's stick with that theme. What's the most important letter you've ever written, do you think?
Oh my God. I suppose I had to write a letter to get into my secondary school.
What is the code for the gate? That's not massively. Did you have to write a letter? Oh, guy, that's because you went to a posh school.
I did go to a posh school, yes. I went to Belvedere College in Dublin city centre. It's a private school, and yes, I had to write a letter which was formed part of my application to be accepted as a student of Belvedere College. And yeah,
okay.
I can't think of another one.
That's important for you.
Right.
I would argue that this is the most important letter currently extant. One of the first things you have to do when you become the Prime Minister of the UK is you have to write a note to the commanders of the four nuke submarines that the Brits have.
Oh, Jesus.
about what to do in the event of a nuclear attack.
Why would they entrust that to a politician? Surely it's a general somewhere who knows what to do.
Well, they're called the letters of last resort. They have to be handwritten. Okay. So it's basically, you know, I'm dead, possibly. You can't get in contact. All is lost in terms of the command structure and all the rest. If you can't get through to the government, one of the tests, apparently, there's loads of tests to go through, but like, can they get Radio 4? Is Radio 4 still broadcasting? is the Archer still on? Can you imagine? So this letter, it has to be handwritten, goes inside a safe, which goes inside another safe, and then it gets sent to the four nukes that are patrolling. Now, one is always patrolling, constantly, right? And they reckon they have 40 warheads available on each Vanguard submarine.
You mean one of the four, as opposed to somebody goes, oh God, I'm after getting on the one that never docks. I'm going to be awake for the next 58 years.
yes.
You mean it's a relay?
No. One drew the short straw originally. Yeah. Three are in dry dock. HMS Marie Celeste is still knocking around. The boys are really pissed off. Yes, they're taking the turns. There's always one of the four moving around. Each warhead, so they reckon they've got 40 warheads, and they reckon that there's each warhead is basically six times what was dropped in Hiroshima.
Jesus.
Right, so you have, so no one knows what's written in these. So some of the suggestions have been, use your own judgment, which is, what a cop out that is. Retaliate. These are the suggestions. Retaliate, use your own judgment, put yourself under the control, under the command control of the US if it still exists.
Okay, now, so when you say nobody knows, presumably the commanders of, when you said it's in a safe, is it kept in a safe?
Yeah, it's kept on the submarine.
So when John Major was replaced by Tony Blair, I have absolutely no idea whether that's the correct timeline. I don't know anything about
it. It is, yep.
Wow, that was a guess. I'm a legend.
Yeah.
I'm a political analyst. When that happened, were John Major's letters taken and destroyed and Tony's ones were put in?
Yes. So what happens basically is you don't have to do it immediately, and the remaining one will stand there for until you write the other one. And you wouldn't do it like just straight away. What would happen is you would be briefed by the various members of your military saying, if we fire this, this is what's going to happen. Tony Blair, apparently, when he realised he had to write the letters, just went completely pale.
Right.
And Theresa May was asked in Parliament about would she ever use a nuke that could kill hundreds of thousands of people. And she said she would. And she said it based on, we have to be prepared to use these. I'm paraphrasing, but the enemy, like, that's the point of it being a deterrent.
Politics is a dirty game and full of rivalry, right? So you may become prime minister at the expense of your rival, you know, across the political divide, who may also in the future want to become prime minister and may succeed you if the votes go that way. So if you really hated the guy, if you thought he had a chance, you write your four letters, but you write three and they're all like full of, you know, wonderful British tally-ho sentiment and defend the lands and the cliffs of Dover and blah, 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 and retaliate as you see fit. And the fourth one is, if Tony Blair wins, I want you to drop a nuke on him before he writes these letters. If he wins, you nuke him. That's the deal. I'm the boss.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Tony Blair wins John Major. I think they'd still be able to contact the sub and let them know.
Oh, this is only the last resort. I think
what would be quite interesting, though, is if it was an audio message and you opened it up and it was just like, hello, surprise, guess what? I was sleeper agent all along. Please return to base and join your new overlords. But I just think that's such a responsibility.
It's wild. Yeah.
Have I told you the time I had to leave a note for a fellow when I was living in town?
No.
So there's two car parking spaces attached to the flat, right? And one for me and then one for a visitor. And my family were coming up and I got home one day and there was a motorbike parked in the guest space. So a little Suzuki. And I left a little note on it because my parents were coming up. And I said, listen, because I had no idea who owned it. And I just said, listen, this is a reserve space. Do you mind not parking here, right? I got down the next day. The bike had been up against the wall and it was moved from the car parking space. But your man was really annoyed at me, and it's clearly a man. So he left a note, but he didn't know who owned the space. So he just left it on his bike.
Right.
And it said, I live in this apartment block. I have a zapper for the gate. If this is confusing to you, ring this number. And he had this number, 086838, whatever it was, right?
Yeah.
The thing is, he's left it on his own motorbike in his own handwriting.
Yeah.
With his own mobile phone. So it looks like he has some sort of brain injury and he's just reminding himself of, I live in this apartment block. I have a zapper for the gate. If this is confusing to you, ring my mobile
ring number, yourself. Right?
So I have nothing to do during the day, so I left him another note, right? I'd said, just because you can't get in the gate with the zapper, you shouldn't be let in. That's a bit weird. I get on the next day, there's another note from him going, you're just a jumped up Hitler with two T's. So I'm in this row with a dyslexic biker, right? He's probably in Hell's Angels, I've always thought. Just riding around in his Charlie Davidson, jumping over buses like he's evil Geneva. So probably didn't even want a Suzuki. Should have bought a zucchini. Anyway, the bottom of his note says PTO. So I flipped his motorbike upside down. I didn't. And the back of his note, it says, the space is big enough for a bike and a car if you would just stop being such an anal asshole.
Right? Wow.
I was thinking, like, what other type of assholes are there? They're like, I see you've one of those cardiac assholes, Dave. I do. A lot of people have a hole in their heart. I have a heart in my hole. So at this point, I'm in this thing now.
Yeah,
so
you're not
the next one was like, dear pen pal, right? I see you can't keep your writing in between the lines, but guess what? You can't leave your shite motorbike there either. Ha! And it goes on for a while.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say. And I just had to end it. So there was a place where you could take a picture of something and they would turn it into a postcard.
Yeah,
and I took a picture of the empty space and got it made into a postcard on the internet, and I left it on his bike, and it said, "Wish you were here." It's probably the weirdest letters I've written, but I have a lot of time on my hands, to be honest with you.
Astounding.
Anyway, let's move on to something. When would you send a letter if you didn't know what date it was? That and other answers to other questions above the time will be answered in part two. We are going to talk to Dr. Matthew Shaw, librarian at Queen's College, Oxford, about the time that France decided Sundays were to be no more.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back to part two of Why Would You Tell Me That? I can't wait to talk to the man we have looking at us from a computer screen, because he is the librarian at Queen's College in Oxford, Dave, and he is a doctor.
Wow.
Of exactly what we want to talk about. Hello, Dr. Matthew Shaw.
Hello. Good to meet you both.
Thanks for talking to us today. Now, all I did in part one is say that France banned Sundays. That's all I said to him. That piqued his interest.
It did.
He's a fluent French speaker, loves France, and I think he wants to know what that's all about. So he has probably figured out by this stage that it is to do with changing the calendar. So before we get to that, can we just have a little chat about what we are using currently in the Western world? We're using the Gregorian calendar. So how long have we been using that, Matthew?
Well, since the 18th century in the UK, but a fair bit before that in the rest of Europe. And more recently in Russia, there was the Julian calendar before that. But as you know, it didn't quite have leap years built in. So the time took the Earth to go around the sun wasn't quite matching up with the year, and gradually everything was falling out of sync. So in the 18th century, we jumped forward and lost 11 days. So some people seem to have lost their birthday and things like that.
So the days just weren't there. They just went, okay, well, now it was X date, but now it's X date.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, Neil, time is a construct. I mean, like, you know, this is all a complete illusion to everybody. Like, we're just hurtling around on a rock in space through passing around the sun. The fact that we measure things in any way whatsoever is all up to us, you know, do whatever we want.
Yeah, but you try and explain that to the person on the train as he checks your young person's rail card. Time is a construct. Please unhand me. Why am I being shoved off this train at 60 kilometres an hour?
Each tick closer to the grave. That's all I know
about it. So, okay, we'll fast forward to the Gregorian calendar is around from like Pope Gregory's time. And obviously we've taken on at different points in different countries. 1582, by the way, is Pope Gregory's time, Dave. So the French tried to change this in the late 18th century. Now, we're talking the French Revolution time. This is quite a complicated time in France's history, shall we say, Matthew. Can you give us a potted history, a synopsis of the French Revolution?
Yeah, I'll try anyway. So the date everybody remembers is 1789, when the Bastille was stormed. And everybody was very happy, seemed to be very happy. There was going to be a revolution, that is, returning constitution back to how it should have been. So the king and the people and the aristocracy and the commoners were all going to be in harmony, and ideas of the rights of man were going to be rolled out, and they would probably emulate what happened in Britain, they thought, with a balance between Parliament and the king and so on. But of course, it all veered, of course, as we know, with the terror, the guillotine, and in particular wars and counter-revolution and violence within France. But what precipitated this? Historians are still arguing about it. There's that old saying, it's too early to tell what caused it or what the French Revolution was about. But essentially, it's a series of a long time of financial mismanagement, the French state spending far too much on war, an inability to raise taxes, and a clash between the king and his ministers, a very ineffective king, King Louis at the centre, not really managing his court, leading to a political crisis in the middle. And then that coincided with a couple of years of bad harvest, riots in the countryside, demanding particular rights, and the most advanced, richest, most powerful country in Europe was overwhelmed by revolution. It was really quite an extraordinary thing.
Wow, and we think Brexit is a mess. I mean, it's incredible.
Nobody has guillotined Nigel Farage yet. Okay, I think that's a perfect synopsis of what is a very turbulent time in French history. So let's cut to what I was talking about. Let's cut to the Sundays. Cut to the 1790s, and the revolutionaries decide we need a new calendar. So what's this new calendar to be based on, and why do they want a new calendar?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And when I sort of looked at it, I started digging around in what we call the Enlightenment. And of course, there wasn't really the Enlightenment. There was just a lot of things going on. And amongst the leading thinkers of that period, Voltaire, Condorcet, and others, there was a real interest in, you know, what is the world about? How do we observe it? How do we understand it? How do we rationally make our way through the world? And so everything was up for grabs: law, religion, and also time, the calendar. And there's a real interest in the Egyptian calendar, the Roman calendar, the classical calendar, the differences between the Hebrew and the Muslim calendar. And these are all published in the Encyclopedia, and which is this great project to sort of categorize and understand and list everything, which kept being banned by the French state, even though most bishops and the king kept buying it as well. And it carried on being printed in France, even though it pretended to be printed elsewhere. And there were several proposals for new calendars. A guy called Marechal, who was an atheist and a poet, he came up with an almanac of great men, of honest men, which was, rather than having saints' days, it had days named after famous people. Like on Christmas Day, it was the day of Newton, for example.
Oh, I quite like that idea, as opposed to the religious hang-ups that still hang around our calendars. I'd be in favor of that if there was a referendum, but maybe not the chaos that would ensue thereafter, but renaming the holidays, perhaps.
Oh my God, you have come to the right episode, Dave, because the French lost their minds. This is absolutely fantastic. So they decided this is going to be kind of around rationality and nature, I suppose you could say. Yeah. So when does it start? It was going to commemorate the revolution, but instead it commemorated the Republic, right?
Yeah, I mean, what it starts off with, everything gets reformed in France. I mean, the thing that you go to France, you go to a particular department, and initially there was going to be 100 of these departments, all in squares, so a very rational sort of division of France. That didn't sort of coincide reality, so something slightly different happened. And there was a desire to reform weights and measures in particular as well, because that was a real problem for everybody. Every single town almost had its own system of weights and measures. So if you're selling grain or wine, sending your wine or oil up to Paris, you'd have to pay customs on it, and the weighing of it would be really complicated. So it makes sense to have one standardized measurement for France. They sort of started to think about how to do that, and they thought, we're going to base it on the natural world. We're going to measure the size of the earth and divide that up by 100,000, and we're going to create a meter's worth of water, and that's going to be a kilogram, and things like that. At the same time as all that going on, you've got the revolution starting, which has a new constitutional form. So you've got the constitutional convention, the national convention, and so on. And then, of course, the king loses his throne and is tried. And suddenly, you're no longer dating your laws by the reign of the king, which is always the way you date it. The third year of Louis VI, Louis XIV, or whatever. This law was passed in the UK, in England. This is the way things done with laws as well. So they had to come up with some way to say, this year is the first year of the French Republic. Newspapers have started to do this as well. It's the first year of liberty, the first year of reason, and so on. But then when did that year start? Was it 1st of January? That's a bit arbitrary. Was it the storm of the Bastille? Was it the date of the Republic, and so on? And so they suddenly decide, we need to sort this out. Let's give it to a committee. So they gave it to the Committee of Public Instruction, it was known as. So education, I suppose, which was also doing the reforms of weights and measures, which was taking a bit longer. And it pulled in some mathematicians, and in particular one guy called Charles-Gilbert Rome, who was a politician, a revolutionary politician, and he really ran with the idea. In particular, he was on mission, as they call it, to Normandy, so the north of France, to try and put down counter-revolutionary activity and to impose the revolution. This is in 1792, when things were beginning to really heat up. Things are getting quite violent. He gets arrested, stuck in prison, which gives him a long time to sit down and work out what this new calendar is going to be. So he works it out, speaks to a few astronomers and scientists to get the measurements worked out, and then presents his reforms to the convention, which is, this point is autumn of 1793, and it's really getting quite violent. The war is going on. There's a battle to the Girondin and Maintenon faction. There's the execution of the queen. there's a limits on the price of bread. There are the sans-culottes, these sort of radical revolutionaries sort of dominating the street. So if you're going to have a dramatic reform, this is the time to put it through.
Right. No one's paying attention to whatever you're saying because there's carnage everywhere.
Yeah, there's carnage everywhere. I imagine him, sans-culottes is without trousers, isn't it? Which seems like an odd name for people in the street. I imagine him in prison. You know, most prisoners do one line for a day and he's like, no, that's not enough for me. And he's doing full on hieroglyphics and... So Gilbert Rome comes up with this. We're going to start from September 21st, 1792. Then,
yeah,
he dates it a year.
Yeah, so it's a good choice in so many ways because it's based on the solar year. So this is when the autumnal equinox is observed. So there's a rational point for it, and also by great convenience, it's the anniversary of the Declaration of the Republic. This is when the first republic is founded. So it would be a year before.
So talk us through the calendar, Dave. You're going to love this.
Yeah, because I've got so many questions, but I'm just being polite and waiting before I ask them.
It has 12 months. And after that, I mean, all time seems up for grabs. Okay,
so amazing.
12 months, Matthew. But after that,
they're also decimalizing everything at the same time.
Yeah.
So weights and measures are going to be decimal. You're going to have 100 centimeters, 1,000 millimeters, and so on. And also weights as well. But you have your 12 months within that. You have 30 days, and then you have three, what we would call weeks, they were called decades or sets of 10 days, the first day, the second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, up to the 10th day, which gives you your 360 days, if you add them all up, leaving 5 or 6 days spare at the end, which they have for a series of festivals. And it seems quite strange to us, but for a revolutionary, it's really been, a lot of these are lawyers, very steeped in the classics. This is quite similar to the Roman and also the Egyptian calendar in many ways. So yeah, so you have your 12 months, 10 day weeks, and then these bits at the end.
10, I love this. So 3 weeks of 10 days each day, right?
Yeah.
And then a day then, of course, isn't 24 hours. It's the same amount of time as 24 hours, but it's 10 hours in a day, and a day is 100 minutes, and a minute is 100 seconds.
Right. Oh my God. What? So, does that add up to 24 hours? No.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah. So you have 5 hours between midnight and midday, and then another 5 hours from very long hours.
Can you imagine, like, how many hours you were? 40 hours a week. Well, 40 hours, that's about 4 weeks, mate. Like, you're just completely different.
So seconds were actually 14% shorter to make things work. So second doesn't last the same amount of time as a second does now.
Right.
But somebody made an argument that this is actually a very good thing because it more naturally matched your heartbeat. I don't know if this is true or not, but somebody claimed that's the case.
Is that a heartbeat before you have been told about the calendar? I'd imagine when somebody tells you the calendar, you go, oh, for fuck's sake.
Wait, the guillotine is slicing down on your neck and see what your heart rate's doing then.
How many fathers or people, men, were convinced that they were the fathers of a child because they couldn't work out if their woman had had an affair? I think the gestation period of this child was 4 months, but I can't be 100% sure. So Gilbert Rome, okay, he's a 42-year-old delegate to the convention, and he likes his physics and his maths. And he kind of gets this committee together, and he has a chemist called Louis-Bernard Guiton, is it? And a mathematician, and the poet. You can pronounce his name, Fabre d'Eglantine? D'Eglantine.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying Neil pronouncing the French, complex French names. This is making me very happy.
Excuse me, je m'appelle Neil de la Mer, David.
Oh, I've no doubt.
So what are the month names then?
Yeah, so the convention gets this rather dry report from, you know, the 42-year-old mathematician and looks at it largely in the same way as Dave just did. But they've, oh no, we are the new republic. This is great. We're creating a new book of history, and we're going to write our history in this blank pages of this rational reform time, which has removed superstitions. You know, it's no longer linked to the Catholic Christian Church. That was a key factor. So in theory, it was open to all religions and those of none. There weren't that many atheists, actually, in the French Revolution. They were sort of deists and things like that. So it wasn't necessarily complete anti-religion. It was just trying to be neutral. But they looked and said, first month, that's not great. There were also proposals for things like naming it after revolutionary heroes, and they have the wit to realize, you know, calling it the Robespierre month or something isn't really going to catch on. So we need something to something a bit more poetical. Hence Fabre Duglingteen's idea. So he goes away, comes back with the second report, which has these slightly more florid agricultural names. So you start off the first month of the year is Vendemeer, and then so the month of harvest, so grape harvest and so on. Seems very French, seems very appropriate, and then works its way through the seasons. So we're now in August, believe it or not, the month of heat, Thermidor.
Thermidor, excellent.
And the spring months are Germinal, of which from germinate, obviously. And you've got Floreal, you've got Brumaire, and that's fog, isn't it? Is that fog? In the autumn, and Pluvios, Ventos, which is wind and rain in winter months as well. So you've got kind of aligning themselves.
Names for months.
Oh, it gets better than this, because Duglingteen also suggested that he name every single day of the year, Dave.
Well, hang on. So 360 individual day names.
Yes, to break the reverence for the beatified skeletons pulled from the catacombs of Rome, I believe.
Wow.
So you may say he's not a devout Christian, I think you could classify him as.
Right.
Yeah, no, definitely Fabre was anti-church. They're very anti the Catholic Church.
Okay, just imagine, you know, somebody from Belgium, just over the border, or Switzerland, saying to a fella in France, here, I meet you on Thursday at 4 o'clock. And the guy says, you mean on Geoffrey Saint-Bain at 2:10 past 6:04? What are you talking about? It's so complicated.
I'm going to give you some subjects, or some nouns, I should say. And I want you to tell me, is this a real day or is it not a real day, Dave?
Oh, brilliant.
Is there a day of the turnip?
Yes.
There is. It's the 23rd. The 23rd of the first month of Vendemeer. What about goose?
Goose day. Foie gras goose. Maybe.
Yeah, it was the fifth day of Brumaire.
Okay.
Spatula.
Oh, come on. I really hope there is, but I bet you there isn't.
No, there isn't. I can't find spatula. but there are, like, wax, cedar, pine, gorse, otter, parsnip, all sorts. There's more than 360 there, or 360 there.
I mean, you absolutely forget your wedding anniversary, that's for sure. Like, it was parsnip, Vendemeer. No, I don't think it was. It was a turnip of Germinal.
There was a day for manure.
Okay, so many potential jokes.
I mean, you can see the whole kind of harvest idea, and it's an agricultural landscape. So did people take this on board, Matthew? Like, this seems to us, obviously, we're thinking it's a little bit crazy, but it was a crazy time, and people looked for change. So did they take it on board, or did they still have two calendars going in the background? Because I assume that if you're Catholic, and some people would want to retain that element of their faith, they need to keep on in touch with when the Sundays are.
Yeah, no, you're right. It becomes a real point of conflict, which is already there, the heart of this sort of revolutionary era, the conflict between the church and the state. The state had sort of commandeered, nationalised the church lands. This is how they're going to solve the financial crisis. But they were also going to keep the church going in a sort of in a national way, as long as the the clergy swore allegiance to the state. And some did, most didn't, and that really led to, well, civil war almost. So if you are following the church's, you know, yearning, you're having your Sunday mass, you would stick out. And the laws changed from time to time about whether or not this was legal or not. Masses for the national church were supposed to be on, all services were supposed to be on the 10th day. So you would see a real conflict there. As to whether people followed it, yeah, that's what I was really investigating. And I kind of concluded that more did than people thought. And the reason for that was sort of varied. The revolution, was popular. People liked it initially, and a lot of people didn't. You know, it was, their lives were pretty miserable. And the revolution really sort of, at first, was giving them rights, which they didn't have before. It was given the say in the government. It was taking the sort of oppressive yoke of the aristocracy off their necks, so they could actually go and do just simple things like, I don't know, catch pigeons that were stealing all their crops, because pigeons belonged to the aristocracy, and that wasn't allowed.
Ah.
And then for the middle classes, there's also opportunity. I mean, it very quickly got messy, and people were unhappy as well. But there, initially, there was a lot, a certain amount of optimism. And you found a lot of children being named after the days of the year or the month and things like that. So there's a sense, a tough day if you're manure or yeah.
Some would say perfectly apt. And what sort of names did you come across?
Yeah, I mean, tends to be the more flowery, floral. Or you make it'll name the month or something. I get a floreal or something rather than the day. But you find people using it in their personal diaries and letters. Not everybody, but they do. Sometimes they draw attention to it. Happy New Year, or as we're supposed to say now, whatever the equivalent is to January. I found somebody writing.
Right.
In the army, which a lot of people have to join, you were trained. This uses the new calendar and so on. The civil service rapidly expands, and they all have to use it. But the other argument I was making is kind of, you know, time was really different then. You know, you didn't have 101 Zoom meetings to get into. If you're a farmer, it's like, when did you plant stuff? You just bought an almanac and followed that. You might want to know when the fairs and markets are, and here's a great opportunity to reorganize the fairs and markets. So your village could actually, finally, we can have two markets a week rather than have to wait one or something. So there's some opportunities.
So so in your research, Matthew, do you find that, looking at it now, even through our modern lens, were there benefits to it? Maybe they were benefits then, as you said, to the rural farmers, but was there anything about it that you kind of go, you know, if this had caught on, maybe there's a logic there?
Yeah, I mean, there's something about 10 days makes things a little bit easier to work out when things are. There's a bit less, the similar, same length from months, and that makes a lot more sense. It's not tied to one particular faith, so that's potentially a benefit. I mean, the drawback is very French. It's not going to Thermidor in south of the equator, or even north of the English Channel or something.
But would you have one few? So I'm presuming that the French peasantry would have Sundays off for worship, and they used to have four Sundays off, but now would they have three?
Yeah, well, exactly. I guess that's the other thing people are always ask about is, oh no, I'm going to miss my weekends. I don't have my Saturday. Yeah. But of course, weekends are very much a mid-20th century invention. And really the history of the conflict between the state and the people, or the church and the people, is we don't want to be told what to do. We want to work as much as we can. We want to be able to work on Sundays because I need to make money and live. There are lots of examples of people trying to stop people having mussel harvesting or harvesting on a feast day or something. You're not supposed to, working obviously in the streets on a Sunday was barred in many towns before the revolution.
Molly Malone was very unsuccessful in the streets of Paris, I believe. Although she was only selling, wasn't she? She wasn't harvesting on the same day. That was
probably
the
not.
Issue there.
Probably not.
So yes, basically you want to be able to work when you want. And the other thing you want to do is dance and drink. And if you're not allowed to dance and drink on Sundays, then suddenly you've got an extra few days where it doesn't matter. You can have your there when you like, or a bal. And this is a great time potentially for conviviality. The idea is the 10th day would be sort of a day of rest, so that's a bit time of conflict in the sense the state might try to impose its view on. But it's a day when everyone's supposed to come together in the village, have a big meal, the new laws are read out, people have marriages take place. And on the fifth day in the afternoon, that's also supposed to be a day, and the villagers perhaps are supposed to get together and have a big communal meal. So fraternity is at the heart of this calendar.
I'm scared of this. I can imagine employers now listening to this and just going, a 9-day week, you say, but we'll give you the half day on the fifth day, but your productivity is going to go through the roof.
I'm slightly expecting Michael O'Leary from Ryanair to pop up during the Zoom call that we're on, just figuring out a way that he can fix the timesheets according to the schedule. Presumably, if it's only France, how does that affect trade with the rest of Europe and further afield who are not using this calendar? If you're a merchant, do you keep two sets of books, sort of thing?
Yeah. And that's a really important point. And it's one of the reasons why the calendar is abolished in the end. It's a hindrance to trade and so on. But you find a lot of publications, I've got one here, sort of an almanac, and they're printed and they show the French calendar, and the Gregorian or the Julian calendar, so you can work out what's going on in other countries, when their markets might be taking place, so you can take your books to the Frankfurt market. But of course, the French are getting quite good at taking over half of Europe as well. So this calendar is being imposed, not very successfully, but the bureaucrats, the army, are told to impose it in in Belgium and so on, and people who are keen on the revolutionary ideals consciously adopt it in these satellite kingdoms, whereas most people are not keen at all, as you might imagine. So it becomes another point of conflict, and kind of a point of conflict which the French Empire really does not need. So Napoleon gets rid of it.
Wouldn't it be the case that you could actually operate whatever calendar you wanted internally if you could help your merchants and help your traders work to the Gregorian calendar, or whatever the global kind of consensus? I mean, like, I know the Ethiopians have a very different calendar now than we do. I think it's 2015 in Ethiopia, and it's 2023, obviously, but they're aware of both. Couldn't you do both? Couldn't, if this had taken off in France in a larger way, would it be possible to have both, to have the internal French calendar and then still reflect what's going on around the rest of the world? I'm sure there are other nations around the world who operate on a different calendar than we do.
That's a really, I think that's really key as well. And so it goes back to how I was looking at how people would have understood this calendar at the time. People were aware there being lots of different sorts of calendars, the church calendar being slightly into the secular calendar, and where there are Jewish communities or people are using the Julian calendar, the Russian and the East of Europe still using that at the same time. Britain was using it until 1752, so calendars were different. People were on different sorts of understandings, and you would pay your rent according to sort of strange lady day and things like that, rather than in 365 days time or whatever. And they're aware of different calendars in the Middle East, which they're increasingly getting in contact with, and the Ottoman Empire is getting increasingly understood, and diplomats and figures and traders and merchants are really pretty tied into the European or the Western European economy. And yeah, and today there are lots of calendars out there around the world which we're not aware of or pretend don't really exist, and sort of colonialism and empires have imposed them on all sorts of places around the world whilst the local calendars are still going on.
Is it true, Matthew, though, according to my research, I'm not quite sure if I got this right, that Joaquin Phoenix was responsible for getting rid of the calendar? The man himself. I think it's Joaquin Phoenix. It may well have been Napoleon. But it is Napoleon who goes, right, yeah. And so it only stays around for about 10 years, is it?
So it starts in 1793. Napoleon crowns himself emperor, and so, you know, he doesn't get the Pope, the Pope is there in 1804, but he doesn't get rid of the calendar. And he doesn't, either's got other things to do, but he doesn't abolish it at a stroke. He gets a commission to say, well, can we sort it out? Maybe there's something that can be done to rationalize it, to make commerce easier and so on. And they conclude, not that it's impractical, not that there shouldn't be lots of calendars or that it's a really bad idea, that there's a sense of that, but there are one or two defects in it astronomically, and the leap year is slightly out of sync. It's very hard to calculate exactly when the autumnal equinox is going to take place, and that sort of moves slightly. So on these sort of scientific reasons, and also they note for reasons of commerce, they decide to abolish it in 1806. So yeah, so that's, you know, it's like 13 years it's going around for. And you know, if you're in the army, if you're in school, you'll be sort of brought up using this thing. And maybe for a while you might have a decimal pocket watch or something, and the church bells might be ringing and that sort of
thing. I did have a decimal digital watch about 10 years ago, and it was just really, it was actually a series of lights. It none of it made sense. It was for people whose physics brains are far better than mine, but I wore it just to confuse people, and it really worked because I had no idea what time it was. There was a button you could press where it would translate it into normal time, so I used that a lot.
I mean, they abolished it. Decimal time or it no longer became compulsory after about 1795 or thereabouts, after the Jacobins have been sort of overthrown and hung around for a bit. But of course, different sorts of time lasted for quite a long time afterwards. Mean time and solar time were two different things. So the hours of the day change as the day lengthens and shortens. If you have 12 of them, you're using a sundial. And it wasn't until the railways came along that mean times imposed and as equal length.
Of course.
So after a couple of years, they lost the decimalization of time. So you still had the 12 months with the unusual names, as we would class them. You still had nonsense days. But they didn't. Then did they have 24 hours a day and 7 days a week at that stage?
They went with them back to 24 hours a day and 10 days in a week. I mean, if you're a really keen Jacobin, you follow this sort of timekeeping, decimal timekeeping for your meetings and so on, and you see people some trying to do it, and you also see some people actually going, well, okay, we're going to meet at 9 o'clock, and which means they're going to record it at whatever that the equivalent of that is, 4:17 or something like that in decimal time. So they're sticking to their old. But other people are having a go at going into the decimal time, but essentially it's showing off. There is a theory that this is going to help boost the economy. Well, let's have lots of new watch factories and competitions to create decimal watches, and everybody will buy them, and it'll great boost to the French economy. But and they get some good watchmakers to attempt to do decimal clocks and things, Bruguette and people like that. But yeah, so now it never takes off. But there are now these very rare, very expensive, very valuable decimal timepieces out there, which
come across one. I don't think my cheap Chinese digital 10 decimal watch isn't really worth very much, to be honest with you.
It was there for a few years, and then it came back for 18 days, just in case you're wondering, Dave.
It came back.
For the Paris Commune, they tried to use this for 18 days. From the 16th of Floréal to the 3rd of Préréal in the 17th year of Liberty. But it didn't last very long, because obviously the Paris Commune didn't last very long. It's an amazing story. I can't believe I've gotten to this part of my life and not heard about the French Republican calendar. Thank you very much for talking to us about it today, Dr. Matthew Shaw. We will never know how many people, Dave, died of food poisoning, because you couldn't calculate whether it was safe to eat or not safe to eat. And you just die. I should have bought the almanac. What an amazing thing to have done many years ago now.
Unreal. Thank you so much, Matthew. Brilliant.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great to talk about it.
Welcome back to part three of Why Would You Tell Me That? Well, Dave, France upended the calendar. Dr. Matthew Shaw explained it so well. What do you think?
I love when France goes off, and when I talked about the way they count their 420s and their 42019, like, they just, when they don't care, they just don't care. And banning Sundays and changing and inventing their own calendars just seemed perfectly fine.
Yeah, I'd love to just... the level of confidence that administration must have had in itself, that we are going to alter time.
Yeah.
You got to respect that.
Oh, they're brilliant. And he was amazing as well. What a great guest and a great story.
Straight from a Queen's University, Queen's Library in Oxford. So what do you got for me next week?
Well, I am treading on your toes and not taking anybody from somewhere as vaunted and as impressive as Queen's Library. I am going to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where I have found a chap called Matt Hobbs, who is a stand-up comedian and a scientist and a moon landing enthusiast. And coming up in next week's episode, Neil, I'll tell you about the lad who got the chance to go to the moon and turned it down.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.